On behalf of the church, I would like to welcome you. We're pleased tonight to be co-sponsoring this event with the Campaign for Adequate Welfare and Disability Benefits. And we're also very privileged to have John Stapleton with us to share his immense experience on the subject of poverty. One of the prime movers in organizing tonight's event was Maggie Hughes, and I'd like to ask her to come forward to perform the rest of the introductions.
Okay, just a couple of things I want to say before we bring John Stapleton up to the stage. Most of us here in this room, we know what poverty is about. We know what life is like. We feel it. We've seen it. Or we're an advocate or an activist for it. We will have some time at the end of the conversation for discussion and questions. That's why we have these mics here. This event is being recorded for broadcast, so just to let you know. One of the two things I want to say before John is I'd like to acknowledge that Wade Robinson just passed recently. He was a long-time advocate for the poor and one of the greater leaders for the activists in the city. If you were new to the city and you wanted to get involved, you wanted to find out what was going on and wanted to do something, you went and talked to Wade Robinson. So I'd like to dedicate this evening in his memory. The other thing I want to bring up, I don't know how many people know about what's going on at City Hall. And if they heard things from City Hall, I would advise you to all get the catch reports, get on their mailing list. They do pretty good coverage of what's going on at City Hall. And very recently, every year the province gives back some money to the cities for poverty programs, mostly for OW, wheelchair fixing, dental, all that kind of stuff. And every year, Hamilton has begged for more money. This year they got $3.6 million. And what they decided to do was divvy it up evenly between the 15 wards. And all but one ward is using that money to pave sidewalks. So I would ask you to send a letter or make a phone call to your counselor. And if you think the money that is supposed to be going to social policy and poverty interests of people is being used to pave the sidewalk in their ward, you should speak up to them. You should have something to say about it. Tomorrow afternoon, OCAP is having a rally for the special diet in Gore Park at 1 o'clock. And then I think they're going to get a bus and fill it with 40 people and go up the mountain to Sophia, thinking I'll never say her last name, I can never pronounce it. But that's the plan, and it starts at 1 o'clock in Gore Park. So that's all of the housekeeping items, and I'd like to introduce our main feature speaker. This is John Stapleton sitting here in front of us. He worked for 28 years or more for the Ontario government in the Ministry of Community and Social Services. He knows how policy is made. He was a senior policy advisor to the Social Assistance Review Committee. He worked to implement the National Child Care Benefit, and that was really, that's quite something. And I think, I hope he's gonna make some notes on that tonight. He's a volunteer for the St. Christopher's House in Toronto. He's a member of 25 and 5, and he serves on the board of directors for the Daily Bread Food Bank. And I'd really like to welcome Mr. John Stapleton to the stage.
I understand that the definition of an expert is somebody from out of town with slides. So I brought along some slides I made so I would be able to fit the bill. I'm going to do two things tonight. I'm going to do the original presentation that I was going to do. I was telling people that this was going to be a double bill. Because 2 days ago, on June 14th, the report of the Social Assistance Review Advisory Council was released in Toronto, and so I wanted to say a few things about that, but I had it in a separate slide presentation, and I worked for about a half an hour trying to integrate them together, completely unsuccessfully, and said I would just try to show a so I'll probably take up a bit more time than I originally intended to do. But at the same time, I'm going to go fairly quickly through the material that I have, but and some of the slides I will not, I won't spend that much time on. But I wanted to leave them all with you so that you would have them to study and look at and use in various different ways later on. So even though if I go over something quickly and you wanted to see more of it, you'll be able to have them. I'll make them available in PowerPoint and in portable document format, which is the long version of PDF. And that software is available for free on any computer, so you can have it in that format too. So what I'm going to talk about first, in the first part of the double bill, is living in the age of the alpha paradigm smackdown. We have two societal narratives right now, two economic narratives. And those are going sort of going against each other right now. I'm going to talk a little bit about that. Then I want to give you some idea of the big picture of social assistance in the context of income security in Canada and Ontario, so you know how big the programs are and how much money they spend. And then I'm going to talk about some long files. And what a long file means, if you're a data person, it means that they where I show you the progress of programs or benefits over a number of years, and in some cases many decades. And then I'm going to say something about the last three big recessions and show you what happened with social assistance in those three big recessions and how caseloads are changing. And caseloads are just the short name for the amount of payments that are being made to people. So when I say the word caseload, I'll be simply meaning the number of payments made to people. And when I talk about beneficiaries, that's all men, women, and children. So it will be a higher figure. And I just wanted to make that remark. And then I'm going to tell you something about social assistance and minimum wages and what's happened over the years. It's really very interesting. And say a few things about welfare, diet, and some tentative conclusions. Then after that, I'm going to switch over to a different PowerPoint. Maybe we can have a few questions or clarifying questions then. I'll switch over to the other PowerPoint that's about the review, and then we'll and then at the end, we can just have a free-for-all at the end then. So in terms of these paradigms, right now, you know, for many years, since Ronald Reagan first came in 1981, you can almost date when something that we call neoliberalism started. And that is the idea that, as he said in his inaugural address in 1981 to the American people, and this is something that we've really taken to heart in Canada, the whole idea that we've taxed and spent and spent and taxed people so that our own generation and our future generations will be mortgaged, as he put it, to the mortgage to the hilt, and that we won't have enough we won't have enough resources, and that the future really looks fairly grim because of the amount of taxation that's taking place. And of course, his idea was that we wouldn't tax more in order to balance books, but we would have fewer taxes. And of course, that's been basically what's been going on for the last 30 years in both in Canada and in the United States. But very recently, we've had a whole new way of looking at things, which I've called the stimulus paradigm. And that's when we got scared about what was happening to the economy and thought we were going to go back to the Great Depression. We've started to borrow and tax and spend and invest, and it's right now we're in a funny piece of time right now, and that funny piece of time is that we don't have a prevailing set of ideas that are going to take us into the future. What we have is two different views of things, and we have this what we call the neoliberal view, that when things are calm, we say, let's have less taxes, and we don't have poverty is an individual deficit that each individual ought to overcome on their own. We shouldn't have anybody in society doing anything for that. We shouldn't have taxes for it because it's really their own fault. And then when we started to talk about stimulus, that is the whole idea that we will put money into the economy and some government money into the economy in order to invest and start talking about things like equality and public services and that sort of thing. And these keep going back and forth between each other. And I've tried to describe them here in terms of taxes, government, families, individuals, inequality in the economy. And again, I'll just let you have these slides at the end to read rather than going through each one. But you can read them as we're going along. And finally, the verdict is that, and this is what I want to leave you with on this particular, the verdict is that when we are fearful, we have tended to talk about we need more stimulus, we need more war, we need more investment. And when we are less fearful, and we're not worried about Europe or Greece or debt or oil in the Gulf of Mexico, we start going back to revert back to the old ideas of less taxes and fewer taxes. And so this is an interesting piece of time, and I think the fact that Mr. Harper, for example, has embraced both of these ideas, I call them either narratives or paradigms, and of course Mr. Gnadiev has done the same thing, that it gives us less choice. So when we're fearful, we think of stimulating, and when we're less fearful, we think the other way. And I think as progressive people, which I assume most of the people in the room would consider themselves to be progressives, and they would be coming to a lecture on poverty and social assistance, is that we got to make sure that when we're talking about investing in the future, we don't always do that in the times when we're fearful of what's going to happen in the economy. We should be doing it at all times. So that's my message on that. So I'm going to say a little bit about the big picture, and you remember the old expression from Jerry Maguire that was a movie, Show Me the Money. It's interesting when we look at the income security spending by program, and what you see, I believe, on the right-hand side of the screen is all the programs for seniors. The one in blue in the top right-hand corner is old age security and GIS. That makes up more than 25% of the whole income security system in Ontario. And I'm sure somebody will ask you at a party or something like that, or a family get together, gee, I wonder how much money we spend on income security in the province of Ontario. And of course, you'll be able to now tell them, oh, that's about $49 billion. And you'll be taken to be a very smart person. And the Canada Pension Plan spends about 30% on programs. And as you can see, social assistance spends about 12% of all of the money in Ontario. And most people think it's more than that. People are not really aware that seniors programs are getting over 50% of the income that's paid out in some of these other smaller programs. So EI and social assistance together, the programs for working age adults, only spend about 22%, less than a quarter of all the income for working age adults. Now for Canada, that total amount is $131 billion, which is somewhere around 10% of our gross domestic product. So if you say how big is our economy, it's about $1.3 trillion. So we spend about 10% of that on income security programs of various sorts. And interestingly enough, when we start talking about social assistance benefits, and especially those for people without disabilities, the amount that's spent on those programs is down to about 6%. And that's very interesting because most people think it's much more than that. And then going back to Ontario again, back to that $49 billion figure, you can see that when we look at by target group, the 47% goes to seniors, 11% to children, persons with disabilities is 19%, but when we get to the program called Ontario Works, it only makes up 4% of all the income that's spent on income security programs. And people have a very, tend to have a very inflated idea of how much Ontario Works, or welfare as we sometimes call it, makes up of this, of the total amount of income security system. And they think it takes up more than it actually does. And when they realize a lot of the income security system really goes to programs that they themselves or their relatives or friends might be part of, they can start to think a little bit differently about the program. So it's really important to point out how small, actually, social assistance is. And it's actually shrinking. And it's shrinking because the programs for seniors and others are indexed, and social assistance has, for many of you will know, have been going the other way. And that's also a very important point. You can start to see that these programs will be less and less. I remember when social assistance made up about 12-13% overall, and that was just the what we would call the welfare program. So it's much smaller now. And again, the $131 billion, when we look across all of Canada, and we even include people who are with disabilities, it's still only 11% in all. And programs for disabilities that are also social assistance programs, like ODSP, take up an awful lot. So anyways, these are some of the denominators, and I don't want to go too far into this and drill down into this data, because it starts to get confusing. But just think that the welfare has a program, and put it together with disability programs is about 11 or 12%, and social and Ontario Works just on its own is only about 12% of the programs. And there's a mythology that, social assistance is a growing program, and its costs are out of control. I frequently hear that in our travels around. So I thought to myself, well, gee, but I'll look over various years, and in this case, looked at 2000, 2005, 2007, and 2009, and lo and behold, the social assistance, where it says social assistance benefits, and then social assistance other, which is drug programs, dental programs, other parts that aren't the monthly check, are the slowest growing parts of the actual overall system. Why? Because the programs don't keep up with inflation. They haven't been regularly increased. They went from 2000 to 2005 with any increases at all. And so you look at other programs for seniors and children, persons with disabilities, CPP, all those programs have gone up much more because they are indexed. So for people who will tell you that welfare costs are out of control because they can't be budgeted, because the amounts of people coming through the door can't be controlled, it's really a bit of a myth, and it's not something should take all that seriously. So where does the money come from? Everybody says, well, the money comes from my taxes. Well, it does and it doesn't. The lion's share, the single largest part of where our income security programs are paid for, comes through federal payroll taxes. So everybody who has worked knows that they get a check or a statement, and they'll have CPP and EI deductions. That's actually where most of the funding for income security programs come from. It just edges out at 40% federal government revenue sources, which is 39%. So most of the people think, kind of unknowingly, well, that money, as a taxpayer, I'm paying for that money that goes to income security programs. Well, 39% of it does. And then provincial taxes is another 13%. Workers' compensation benefits that are paid by employers is about 6%, and finally municipalities, which are most strapped, and this is always the big irony, that municipalities pay the least amount into the income security system, but they're the ones least able to do so. It's a very interesting point. Now, I'm getting into the long file and the megatrends right now, and what I've shown you here is the longest file I have, and there, well, maybe there's one other that's a bit longer, but this one goes from 1935, and the reason that 1935 was chosen is because that's the first time during the Great Depression that cash assistance was paid to people in the form of relief. I know there's been many interviews with people who have been over 90 years old, and they say, you know, you go back to the 30s, they didn't pay cash, they paid you go into an office and you'd get food, and you'd get a bag of coal, and you'd get shoes, and a clothes hamper, and that sort of thing. Well, they didn't start giving out money for relief until July of 1935, And when you go back there, we found that they didn't pay $200 a month back then, but this is all adjusted for inflation. And what I want to show you here is that for many years, these amounts went up, right up to 92. And what the taller pink line or magenta line is a lone parent with one child, and the lower line is a single person getting the equivalent of Ontario Works. It was one time called GWA, another time it was called unemployment relief, etc. But what you can see is that it generally continued to increase up until 1992-93, and then you can see in 1995 what happened. Those are the Harris cuts that you can see in there, the 21.6%. And then they continued to erode to inflation through until in 2003 or 4. And then the McGuinty government, generally speaking, kept social assistance rates up to date. But and you can see that with the single. But then they have started to fall too. And what you see right at the end there is where the restructuring of the social assistance program took place for mothers and other and families with children, and the OCB, the Ontario Child Benefit, took over in there. So this chart, as some of the policy analysts would tell me, is not entirely fair, because there have been many child benefits paid outside of the social assistance system that have been added since the mid-90s, and that's quite true. And I think you'd find that the lone parent has probably just kept up with inflation when you include the universal child care benefit, the what we call the CCTB, the child tax benefit, the national child benefit supplement, and the new Ontario child benefit. If you add all those in there, this line here would probably go out straight like that. She's probably kept up to inflation. But what the real story of this recession, and over the last 15 years, has been is single-person poverty. And you're going to see a little bit more than that, more on that. Single people in Ontario and Canada have been the ones who have really lost out as far as the recession goes and in terms of social policy making. So let's think about the last three big recessions, because we've been talking about recessions for a while, and there's something that we call in this business, if you're an economist or a social policy analyst, you call the post-recession shift. And what that is that the recession comes and then it goes, and then things start to get worse at the end of the economic recession as defined by the economists. And the reason for that is a program called Employment Insurance is time limited. People get employment insurance at the start of a recession when they lose their job, and then they exhaust it after about 10 months or so, and about 10% of all those employment insurance recipients or claimants start to come on to social assistance. And so we had a recession in 1980-82, and social assistance, the amount of people on social assistance, peaked in March 1983, so well after the recession. And then we had a recession, a big one in 1990 and 91, but social assistance caseloads, the number of people and people on social assistance, did not peak until March 1994 at almost 13% of Ontario's population. So now we have the Great Recession of 2008-09, and Ontario Works caseloads went up until March 2010, and then they've had a drop in April of 2010. So we don't really know whether we've reached that point where social assistance caseloads are starting to go down. But it was the first month, April of 2010, with consistent increases across the province up until that point. So let's try to put this graphically. And what you see, this is another long file. This is a file that starts back in 1981. And social assistance and the percentage of population on the unemployment rate versus the percentage of people on social assistance didn't really follow each other back in 81. And that's because we had something called an EI program that covered about 80% of the population. EI program now covers 37.4% of the population, which is a very big reduction, And as a result, many people have to go to social assistance right away because they don't qualify for EI. And so you can see at the beginning of the 1990s that unemployment and social assistance start to track each other. And you can see how both of the both of the curves went up in the early 90s. Here, and then they started to follow each other down during the Harris years, and then you can see that they started to go up as the Great Recession of 2008 took hold. You can see unemployment going up and social assistance starts to follow it. So this is a graph that shows you all of the last three recessions going back to '80s. You can see how unemployment spiked up in '82, but social assistance really wasn't following it. Then it started to, then in the 91 to 94 period, unemployment and social assistance followed each other again because we didn't have a strong EI program, and especially in Ontario. And now we're seeing, we're living in the middle of this where unemployment has gone up and it's just started to turn down and social assistance has started to follow. So what happens here when we take a little bit closer look? What I've done is taken all of the last 15 months and sort of and put them at the right side of the slide here. And what it shows is unemployment starts to go down, social assistance keeps going up. Why? Because EI is a time-limited program. People go off it, and then they start to come on to social assistance. So for those of you who are interested, we are now at a point of 6.4% of Ontario's population is receiving social assistance, and that's up from about 5.5% going back to when the Liberals first came in 2003. So we've gone up about 1%, not nearly as high as we did in the previous recession. And I'm about to tell you some of the reasons why. One is that the Ontario Works program is a much tougher program to get on than it was back in the early 1990s or before that. So you have a lot of people who come off of EI, but they still can't get on to social assistance because of how tough the program is to get on. And so there's another closer look here where you can see going back just to June 2007 that the first set of rumblings that the economy wasn't going so well and unemployment and social assistance cases were starting to track each other. Then you see unemployment, that's the blue line, goes way, way up to this time last year when it started to moderate. But you see how what we call convergence, and that is that that blue line and that red line start to come together. And as time goes on, you'll see unemployment continue to come, it'll remain stubbornly high, but it'll start to come down, and social assistance caseloads will go up. And it's important to know that that's exactly what you would expect to happen. It's really surprising that unemployment and EI is starting to go down, but social assistance is staying stubbornly high, and this is a big mystery. Well, ladies and gentlemen, it's no mystery at all. This is how they set it up to work. This is how it does work, and this is how it's always worked. So again, EI is kind of limited, social assistance is not. So there is, again, this is the regular beneficiaries in Ontario of EI, and it shows that it peaked about half 9 months ago, and took a dip down. Now it's dipping down again. And people look at that graph and they say, gee, that's good news. But you got to remember that people coming off the other end are people who have exhausted their EI. They're no longer eligible for it, and even though they might be still unemployed. And the numbers are going down, which is good news to a lot of people. It doesn't really tell you the full story because those are people just coming off the back end of the program because it is kind of limited. So what has happened over the years? Things are not the same. They're very, very different, in fact. And if we go back to 1988 in Ontario, the overall cost of the program and the overall share of the program for people with disabilities was 32% of all social assistance, was less than a third. But now in 2010, the ODSP program represents 60% of social assistance and is still growing and continues to go up each and every month, even though Ontario Works started to moderate. So that's very interesting, and that has to do with the aging of the population. As we get older, we're not as well as we were in our younger age. It has to do with people being deinstitutionalized. and coming out, where they didn't get benefits inside an institution, but do once they come out, and deinstitutionalization is still happening. It has to do with medicine that allows people to function in the community. It has something to do with trauma and people. At one time, most trauma victims would die of their various injuries, and now people are surviving and often very disabled. So there's not one thing that you can point to, but I think what you're going to start to hear, and it's something we really got to guard against, is people saying that people with disabilities are, it's growing, and it's growing faster than the population, which is all true. But at the same time, you're going to hear people saying, well, a lot of people are on disability benefits that actually don't need to be, and that sort of thing. And we pointed out that the growing caseloads is evidence of that. And I think we have to look at the many complex reasons for that. Now, lone parents is really one of the, in many ways, one of the success stories. Because in 1995, they outnumbered single people by 2-1. On Ontario Works and its predecessor programs, Family Benefits and General Welfare. But what happened is they equalized at about 95,000 singles and 95,000 lone parents in 2000. But since 2000, since the turn of the millennium, we don't talk about turn of the century anymore, since the turn of the millennium, singles have increased by 57%, and lone parents have decreased by 21%. Even though we went through this recession, the amount of lone parents receiving assistance has gone down by 21%. And again, so things have really, really changed here. So the lone parent story, because of all those child benefits, and because after 20 years of doing things maybe not as well as they could, the program that gets support payments from absent parents is doing better than it had in the past. And so we're seeing a lot of younger lone parents, young women who are more disposed to, or more oriented to work, and with their child benefits and their child support are able to do so. And so this is a bit of a success story, but a guarded one, because many of them continue to live in poverty. But the real story of this recession has been the single person. And the real story of Canada's recession and Canada's place in the world is single people. And this is continuing to be a story for us nationally and internationally. Now, showing you just what you see here is a 10-year file showing how the proportion of singles keeps going up. So it's not just Ontario, which is what I was showing you before. It's all across Canada. And the lone parents, the single parents, have been going down in terms of social assistance. And it's important. So I hear a lot of scholars and others talking about, you know, the real face of poverty is single parents. It's really not the case the way that it was at one time going back a few years. So let's look at other provinces, and I put Quebec and Ontario and BC, the three largest provinces in there, and you can see that trend is the same in each of those provinces, where the single people, regardless of their EI weeks and all that sort of thing, the single people are going up, and the lone parents are going down in numbers. So it's a very important trend in terms of the demographics. Now, when we start to look at different parts of Ontario in terms of the number of people and the percentage of the population receiving social assistance, look at Toronto and look at Hamilton, are up around 9%. London and Windsor, in fact, even higher. Then look at places like York Region or Halton, which are down about 2%. So the story of poverty is very, very different around Ontario communities and municipalities. It's not the same. And you can come up with as many reasons, I'm sure, as I can, about zoning and single-family dwellings and restrictions that don't allow people living in poverty to live in some of these municipalities. So the share of folks who are poor can be very different in different regions across the province. This is going back to December last year. And I wanted to tell you about one of the myths of when we talk about the old days. We often talk about where things were tougher. And There's certainly a number of areas where that just isn't true. And the one of those that I wanted to tell you about was assets. And if we go back to 1950, 1951, the Unemployment Relief Act used to allow $250 in assets to a single person. Well, that $250 now, if you follow that red line, is now up around is over $2,000. It's close to $2,200. But the amount we allow in assets, and that was brought in by Mr. Harris in 1995, was only a single month's assistance. And so that's grown now to $585. So it's much, much less than it was years ago. We've been much, much tighter on assets and the amount that we allow people. And even though during the 80s, I called this a roller coaster in a paper I wrote, because the blue line shows the actual asset limits in various years. And of course, they went up to 2,500 for unemployable persons back in the around 1980, and then came crashing down in 1995 with the Common Sense Revolution. And when we look at lone parents, we find somewhat the same thing, that in 1948, in George Drew's Ontario, who was premier back in 1948, they set the asset limit for mothers on mother's allowance at $1,000. And now, if we had just continued to index that with inflation, we'd be up well over $10,000 that we'd allow a lone parent to keep. But the amount we allow her to keep is around $1,600. So those programs that we think are, we always look back at the old days as being tougher. This is really an instance where, when we look back, the old days were a little bit more generous than they were today. And right now, if a person goes over the asset limit, whether a single person or a lone parent, if they go over the asset limit, then they're ineligible. Back in 1948, they simply said, well, if you have assets that are over the limit, spend them on the child, and we'll allow you to stay on the allowance. So there's nothing like that now. So they were tougher and more, not just in monetary terms, but also in terms of the eligibility rules. So minimum wages, and this is really one of the important trends to look at. David Kroll, who became Senator Kroll and did a report on poverty in the 1970s, he was a young minister in Mitch Hepburn's cabinet back in 1934, and he set the first social assistance or relief rates in 1935, and then Hepburn moved them over to the Ministry of Labor, where he came up with the first generally available minimum wage laws. So he was a very busy guy back in the depths of the Depression. And he was only a young guy, too. So he was born in 1900, so he was 34 in 1934, and only 37 when he brought in the first generally available minimum wage laws. And it was set at $12.50 a week back in 1937, and the relief rates were about $19 a month. So that was 36%. So what you have there is the amount that the relief rates or the welfare rate at that time represented about 36% of the minimum wage. Now that rose through to 1990-91 to 70%, and probably minimum wages were a bit too low. I'm not going to say that social assistance was too high in 1990, but I'd say that minimum wage was very low. And when it grows to the point where social assistance is 70% of the minimum wage, that's just too high. But who knew that in 1991 that this would relentlessly fall back for the next 20 years? And here we are. So if you want some parallels to the Great Depression, we're now back to that 36%. So really what you're seeing for a single person who comes on to Ontario Works, the amount of money they could get in a year is about $7,000. Whereas the minimum wage now, full time, is about 37 hours a week. In fact, it's about $20,000. And for the hours that most minimum wage workers can get, which is what's sometimes called subway sandwich hours, it's the 31 hours per week they can get. But that's still about $15,000 or $16,000. So we know that the people who are forced to be on social assistance are really struggling with grade 12, business English, and other issues that they may have, like addiction. So it's really important that we not see people as employable as the phrase sometimes goes. they really need, there's an awful lot of work that needs to be done. So here is the long file, and I've taken this one back to 1967, where the what the blue line there is annual social assistance, and then the red line is gross annual income at minimum wage of 37.5 hours a week. And you see in 1967 they were very close to each other, and then they started to diverge. And of course you can see in 1995 where the 21.6% cut and social assistance fell, and it's hardly moved at all. But minimum wages have gone up quite smartly under the McGinty Liberals since they came in 2003. But when we put these, when we put them together and have the single social assistance rate as a percentage of the minimum wage, you can see that it reached that high point in 1991 and then has continued to fall back down to 2010. So it's very interesting. We're very different times now. So when people say nothing's really changed, it's really important that you realize that things are really changing. And so there's quite a bit of room to raise the incomes of single social assistance recipients and still have quite a bit of incentive in the system. So all that talk we used to hear of, well, people would rather go and sit on welfare than they would rather work, is really not true at all. And any truth that it had at all really is we're looking back to the very early 1990s. So we know that work has changed, and what this pyramid shows you, that an awful lot of work has been outsourced, and that's what the right side of the that diagram says. And so a lot of people are forced into very precarious employment. They're forced into jobs where they have to sign contracts for amounts that might not even be very insecure amounts. And that's part of the overall equation why we have the social assistance that we have today. So in terms of jobs, just say a little bit about jobs, and looking at that green line. But if we go back to 1901, we can see that most of our, it's called FFF, and that is fishing, forestry, farming, right, of course. And we can see that that's moved from about 45% right down to under 5%. And the two forms of work that are in their ascendancy is what's called knowledge labor. That's people who mostly work with their heads and sit at desks, or who teach, and etc. And and that's called the creative class. And then we have the service class that's also increased, and that's that blue line that's also going up. And so a lot of the jobs for people who would be living in poverty or near poverty are going to be in that service area. And it's in the big cities, it's in support of these people that we call the creative class. So the working class in manufacturing is dropping, forestry, fishing, and farming is going down, and all of these others are going up. And that's also very important in terms of the types of jobs that people are going to get. I'll skip this one. This is one that, you know. Finally, I just want to talk a little bit about the welfare diet. Does anybody remember the welfare diet from Tuna Dave Tabucci in 1995?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, he had a special diet that he put out that somebody, he set up somebody receiving social assistance could live on. And I reshopped it at my local super center in February and found out that food inflation is rising much faster than CPI. And bad food rising, that sounds like a song, doesn't it? is rising faster than good food. And so what you see on that green line there is the actual cost of what Tabucci called the welfare diet. If it started out at 100 in 1995, it's now up at about 143. So that's 43% increase in food inflation. But then look at the real rate of inflation, actually is less than that. And that's the red line. And then, of course, you can see the blue line, which is how much social assistance has gone up in the meantime. So those of you who hear about the term food security and the difficulty in buying food, that's an important part. So don't call for social assistance increases that go with the rate of inflation, because if you do, you'll be asking for rates that are below the rate of food inflation. But there's an interesting part to this that I haven't showed you. And on this slide, it shows that the fruit and veggies is the good food is actually tracking below inflation, and that's good news. But I'm going to have bad news in a minute, and that is all those high cholesterol things, the grains, the meats, the dairy, and that sort of thing are tracking much higher than inflation. So what happens if you're on social assistance? You go to the local store, and do they have fruit and vegetables in the local store? Usually not. You have to go to the supermarket for that. And so what we see is that the poor people are forced to buy bad food in what we call food deserts, and then the people of the middle classes are able to go to the big supermarkets and have much more access to those because they've got the big parking lots and you can drive your car there. And actually benefit from the lower cost food. So again, and this is a real important when we talk about the puzzle of obesity amongst the lower income people. It's really explained a lot by this slide. So rates don't keep up. The welfare single rate now is $585 a month, and if it had been indexed going back to before Mr. Harris hit them, wouldn't it be close to 900? I can now say, ta-da, it would be about $901. So this slide is a couple months old. So it's really down $314 in real terms, and ODSP is down about $242 because ODSP, back when it was called the Gains Program, used to be about the same as what seniors got. So now it's fallen well below that. So we had a special diet of up to $250, but it was terminated. But at the same time, those rates are already $240 to $314 down from where they'd been if they would index. So some people were able to get some of that back because they got the special diet allowance. But now that that has been terminated, then they're not even able to get back to where they were, and that's very important. So we've had, in many ways, the special diet cut is really what we can call a selective rate cut, as was Harris's in 2005. And many of you will not know that there was a big rate cut in 1938, where rates were cut by 15% when the province brought all the municipalities out of bankruptcy. And there was going to be a great big fight about that in early 1939, and then Canada went to war and everybody forgot about it. And that's why most people don't remember the 1938 rate cut, or even from the history books. So some conclusions. Earlier I told you the mythology of social assistance, it is really the most contendable cost. It's one that has not gone up at all. Indexation is the federal rule, the provincial exception. Social assistance is a much smaller expenditure, and unfortunately predicted will get much smaller because of the indexation issue. The rates are really in what I call serial decline. They've continued to decline from 1993 and are still doing so, and especially with governments that face $24 billion deficits. The caseloads are heading towards the single person. We're seeing more and more single person, and 60% of all the single caseload increases over the last couple of years are men, and they don't have the same access to those service jobs in many cases. There's educational issues, but we're seeing that most in the area of men. Actually, it's at 60%, it's 58% of all the new single applicants are men. So that's very disconcerting. So men, on the one side of the equation, get paid much more than women, but that is mostly in the knowledge industry. But on the other side of the equation, so we have men making the most money and also men making the least money, which is kind of interesting. So minimum wages and welfare were out of whack in the early 1990s, and that's why we got up to 14% of Ontario's population receiving social assistance. But now they're out of kilter in the opposite direction. 36% is very, very low. Like when you're looking at the difference between 7,000 and 20,000. Food is a growing issue. You keep hearing about food and food security. I've tried to show you on those couple of graphs why it's an issue, and the fact that food inflation is higher than regular inflation. And bad food, of course, for people who are unable to get people say that the poor shop for calories, the middle class shops for nutrition, and the rich shop for presentation. And so you can see that it's very important that we understand what is a growing obesity epidemic and why it's happening. It's the unavailability of food, and the food that is available is very expensive. So I won't. Phil Graham is the one, the American senator, the senator who said that the that he thought that poverty in America was illegitimate because there's so many of Americans poor were overweight. Really didn't understand what that epidemic is about. So we had Ontario rate cuts in 2010. Unfortunately, our provincial auditor didn't do a very good job in understanding what the programs were all about, and found a very distrustful system. He found lots of what he called fraud in that system, fraud and errors in the system. And of course, if you build a system to have fraud and errors in them, it will have fraud and errors in them. And of course, that's what he found. So the good news is low-income parents are at historic lows. Child benefits have supported that, child support. And many more young women are doing much better in the labor force, as I just mentioned. And the bad news is really the single, the story of the recession of 2008-2009, and how we're seeing many more single people on receiving disability. And so that's really something that's going to be important for us to discuss and important to think about over the coming years, why so many single people are having to resort to destitution. So that's the first part. Is everybody tired out yet?
My name is Sam Chino. I usually speak out as a child advocate, rights of children. But I've been in child poverty, in poverty myself by government institutions. 4 years, 5 years, courts, etc. Well, what is your idea? You're handing out money to people who need it. But what is your idea of preventing poverty in the first place? Well, I myself, there are government institutions who contribute greatly to poverty and not held accountable. Like I was, my child, and I have millions of farmers, not just myself and children, who have been brutally raped by government institutions. And then everybody just laughs and thinks that you go to a politician, he says, go get a good lawyer. The lawyer takes your money, and you're automatically in poverty. You know, the next thing, your children, they take your children away. You know, and no one, not one politician speaks out about this corruption. They all turn away. And yet we have people who are in need of assistance. I myself cost the taxpayers $250,000. 50 times in court. But that's money that these people here need. You know, and I don't see anyone, no politician there to speak out one word bad about this corruption that we have. There's no accountability. When you have no accountability of these government institutions, you have the largest organized criminals of child abusers running about. We have priests who are saying, bring your children to me because I'm close to God. We have judges and lawyers and the children aid to me saying, bring your children to me because I have the law. We're now sending priests in jail. How long is it going to be before we send judges and lawyers and politicians in jail? How many more children have to die?
I know that about 1995, a big problem with people living in poverty was the rent rate. And so I was very interested to see the food rate, but I was wondering about the rent being included in that equation.
I got one question over here, John. Somebody handed me a question. They wanted to know who is a single parent and who is a lone parent.
Oh, okay. Just so I remember all the questions, I'll go in reverse order. Single and lone parent are just the same thing. It's just that most researchers nowadays have started calling what we did call single parents, lone parents, and saying that because it refers to their marital status, and lone parent refers to the fact that they're raising the child alone. So in some quarters, lone parent is a better phrase for single parent, but it's still, they're still synonymous. Going backwards through the previous speaker had talked about the shelter rates. And in the recommendations that I'll get to in a minute about the income security review, we talk about the idea of having a new housing benefit. And a new housing benefit that would go on top of the social assistance that we have now and be available in a portable way to the working poor, to people who are receiving social assistance, and also those people who are ineligible for social assistance because they're homeless and can't meet all the paperwork requirements. And we feel if they were to be able to pay for their shelter costs, then they'd have more money that was left in their other part of the budget to go to the food. The problem with just raising social assistance rates is that often goes to the landlord when those amounts are raised, and so it doesn't necessarily go to the recipient so that they're able to put it into the food budget. So we've recommended a housing benefit as part of this paper that came out 2 days ago, and I encourage you to read it. In terms of the child welfare system and the comments that were made about that, and it's an absolutely huge concern. We've got 18,000 children right now who are in care in Ontario, and those kids come out of care when they're 18 years old, and they're just forced out. At that time, if you can imagine somebody living at home who has an 18-year-old and they have their birthday, their parents don't take them down to a shelter at the on their 18th birthday and say, well, here you go, here's your new home now. But that's exactly what the Children's Aid System does. And they have a small amount, it's called extended care and maintenance, which in many cases is hard to get. And so the kids that our Crown Awards, Society Awards, and who go in and out of care are in a very, very vulnerable situation, as the gentleman pointed out. And for those who are interested, I and a partner of mine recently did a report on the child benefits who are available to kids who are in care and how difficult and complex that system is. And we called it not so easy to navigate, and I brought a couple of reports here. But the larger systemic issues, I think, I won't repeat them. They were already made very well by the gentleman who spoke about those. And then going back to the first question, I think it's important to note that when talking about the corporatization of Canada and of the world, what we're really seeing in many cases is that when we look at Canada's position in the world, we spend lower than the average country on our social programs. We're, I think, somewhere around 17%, where the average for the world is about 20%. And certainly people who are, when we look at the last recessions going all the way back to the 30s, we know that every time we had a recession, we started after that recession to put in more social programs in place. But as you saw with that one slide that I showed you where everything increased in 92 and then went down from there, it's really demonstrable that in the last recession and the recession and the current recession, we're starting to see cutbacks in social programs at a time when we really should be seeing the increases to them, because when people are in greatest need, that's when they will need the greatest benefit. And so I certainly understand the point that was made. You have a comment?
Yeah, let's just do this last comment, and then maybe John, you want to present your second?
Yeah, and I'll do a shortened version of it, and then everybody can get a hold of it later. Yeah, just so that we get everybody out of time, people get a chance to talk about it.
Yeah. You mentioned the change from the single parent and the increase in loan adult rates.
Yeah.
But the time frame to me seems almost generational, so I was wondering.
It is generational.
Yeah, so basically what's happening is the kids are aging out. Families are the single parents are reducing to single adult status. Is that where we're
going? Not generally speaking. What we're seeing that the number of lone parents receiving social assistance in about 1970 was about 75,000, and then it went up to over 150,000 in the mid 90s, and now it's back to under 75,000. And what you're seeing is that the increase in various forms of child benefits, child support, as well as the lone parent mothers are tending to have fewer children when they become lone parents. We often saw families of four or five back, you know, 10, 20, 30 years ago, seeing with less children. They seem to be better able to cope, and being able to cobble together, say, a small job, and putting that job with child support under child benefits, when you put them all together, then they don't have eligibility for social assistance, and they're able to make their way better in the work world, because they don't have any deductions in their benefits until they get to $20,000. Whereas, you know, with Ontario Works, for the first dollar, you're going to have 50 cents taken off your check.
And the other thing I was wondering was, there's a school of thought that says that more social assistance and more money will actually pull people out of poverty. There's another school of thought that says economic improvement will do it better. What would your opinion be on that?
My feeling is that we, and this goes back to questions that relate to general income programs. We had welfare for seniors in the 30s. And in fact, the welfare program we had for seniors, what we called an old age pension at the time, was really a thinly disguised welfare program. By the 1970s, we had a program that we called old age security. It was destigmatized, it was delivered to people who turned 65. We didn't have asset limits on them and income charges the way we did back in the 30s. So we generally elevated those programs, and we paid a basic benefit, an income-tested benefit, and then gave people various forms of registered savings programs and pension and CPP. The same thing happened really with kids. We now have a child benefit, base child benefit, an income-tested benefit in the National Child Benefit Supplement and the Ontario Child Benefit, and then other programs that brought in, like the Canada Learning Bond and the Canada Education Savings Grant. What we've done is generally left working age adults out of that equation. The benefits that are paid to working age adults at the federal level, EI, are not indexed. At the provincial level, and social assistance are not indexed. And the working income tax benefit are not indexed. Yet all the programs we have for children and seniors are indexed to the rate of inflation. Not a big deal now when we have low inflation, but if it returns, then we're going to see those programs start to fall apart again, especially if we see an increase in the age of people. So I think we should start to build programs outside of social assistance that are generally available, that are not stigmatized, and allow people to make their own way in life. And perhaps a shelter, a housing benefit, as we have in Quebec and Manitoba, will be a part of that. I'm an old benefit designer. That's what I did at the Ontario government when I was there for those years. And so I get too technical very quickly, but that's generally the flavor. Okay, I just want to make you aware that there is there was an Ontario Income Security Review, or there was a Social Assistance Review that a number of us were asked to do. There was 11 of us, and we went away and did that, and the report that we gave to the Minister, Madeleine Meagher, in May, was just translated and was brought out on June 14th, so Maggie did not ask me here to just to speak about that, because we didn't know it was coming out, and we only learned very recently that it was. So I thought that I would tell you a little bit about that that review from that advisory council, and I'm going to get to the six strategic directions that we see very quickly. The case for an income security is really easy to make. We have a program in social assistance that people who receive it don't like very much. People who deliver it find it very difficult to deliver, and the general public generally sees it as a program that doesn't have a good reputation with them. And so we thought that if there was any way that we could transform the social assistance system into a system that was popular for the people who receive it, for those who deliver it, and those who are members of the public, it would be a good thing to do. We think there's a broad consensus for reform, and we believe that the current system is deeply flawed. We have a program As we pointed out, we have over $25 billion spent on pre-retirement programs in Ontario, and when you put the retirement ones together with it, it's almost $50 billion, as I've showed you before, and there has to be a better way to spend $49 billion than the way that we spend it now. These programs that we have just evolved in place and haven't really been put to serious scrutiny, and we think they should be. And especially, why do we have some programs that are indexed, others that are not? Why do we have programs with that are stigmatized for some people, and then other programs that are not? And why do we have programs that, where we, generally speaking, as a society, take care of persons who are aged? I know there's exceptions, the same is true for children, but working age adults, and especially those singles, are really at the bottom of the barrel in terms of social policy priorities. So we wanted a new program that would support economic transition and build for the future, and rather than just looking at social assistance, we wanted to look at the entire system, including EI. There's no reason why anybody should lose their job, go on EI for a few months, and then have to cash out all their RSPs just in order to, if they're going through a rough patch. That just doesn't make any sense. So we wanted to address the real needs and aspirations of Ontarians. People are looking for real opportunities, and there's no point in making them destitute and then telling them that they ought to pull themselves up. And that speaks to those asset limits. So we look at that a program should aim to contribute to labor market opportunities and pathways out of poverty, provide workforce development, related services, and support Ontarians in good and bad times. People said this is a bad time to do a review, and we said no, it was the best time to do a review because we have the most people in need now that we've had in a generation. So we thought that reviewing social assistance alone didn't make sense. We think that all the other programs need to be reviewed at the same time, even those at the federal level, and also the disability programs. When you say somebody's on disability, they can mean any one of seven different things. You could be talking about EI sickness, you could be talking about Canada Pension Disability, you could be talking about workers' comp, disability tax credits, veterans benefits, ODSP. All those programs are disability-related programs, but they're all different, all with different sets of rules, all with different benefits that tend to do very different things. And we think that there's the money that's spent there could be spent in a much better way if those programs started to work together more than they do now. So we want to recommend a comprehensive income security review. And this slide repeats it. It says a few more of the words that were in the report. We had six strategic directions. The first was building on the approach of the Ontario Child Benefit and develop an expanded range of income services for all low-income Ontarians, working poor, those people who can't get into the system, as well as the ones who are there now. And as I mentioned earlier, the third line here, the idea of examining housing benefit paid outside of social assistance that's specifically meeting the needs of people, because the social assistance increases just go to housing, the landlords raise the rates, and then we're back out again. And we wanted to de-link some of the things like drug cards and dental cards. What we mean by de-link is allow people, when they go into work and are still in working poverty, that they still be able to keep a dental card, still be able to keep a drug card, rather than now where you lose everything when you leave assistance. We wanted to strengthen initiatives such as minimum wage increases and employment standards and fair employment initiatives and continue improvements there. Replace the short-term coverage in Ontario with more appropriate financial support. And what we mean by that is that when we go off, somebody goes off EI in 10 months, that might not be. A recession can last longer than EI, and given that there should be something there, we shouldn't just put them on the destitution of Ontario Works at that point. Fourth, to re-engineer the long-term coverage in Ontario Works, and rather than policing people and chasing people around for all sorts of paperwork, that what we should be doing is really giving them something that was coined 20 years ago, and that was the idea of opportunity planning for real opportunity. And so caseworkers would be freed up to offer people opportunity planning as opposed to simply chasing them around for pieces of paper to verify things that the system largely already knows. Five is to develop standards for a livable income. Some people call that a living wage, some people call it a livable income, other people call it an income guarantee. There's lots of different words for it. Some people call it negative income tax. Anyways, there's various different ways to do the same things, but really the issue is to pay money in a non-stigmatized way and pay them in an adequate amount that recognizes people's work effort as well as their aspirations. And also we talked about the negative interactions between programs. Sometimes people are in housing, 30% comes off for rent increases, and then 50% comes off their check for the ODSP and OW clawbacks, and then they have to pay for childcare and work expenses, and it's not long before people who are making a dollar are losing more than a dollar, and that doesn't make any sense. We should have a system that always allows people to make more, to realize more when they make more. The sixth of the six strategies is improve income and social supports for those with reasonable prospects of earning livable incomes from employment are limited by disability or other circumstances, and make sure that we have an appropriate set of programs in place. Right now I mentioned that we have those seven programs, sometimes that don't work well together, and it's important that we have those programs working better together, especially in times where we're saying we don't have, where funds are limited, then those programs should work better together. We had seven outcomes for those of you that these slides were done very quickly, and if you count the bullet points quickly, you'll see that there are only six. And I discovered this presenting it the other day. So the outcome, the first outcome, which isn't here, is a livable income. We talked about social and economic inclusion, autonomy, human capacity development, that's part of the opportunity planning. Public and fiscal sustainability, the gentleman earlier talked about how much money could be spent, like $250,000. Many of you will have read Malcolm Gladwell's Million Dollar Murray, where somebody, rather than just putting the person into housing, spent million dollars in terms of medical care out on the streets. We can spend money better, and especially at times when we're worried about money, we should do that. For public and fiscal sustainability. So that's not about cuts, it's just about doing things that make sense. Fairness, equity, and transparent, and finally, empowerment of individuals. In terms of the review structure and process, we were just the guys that told the government how to do a review. We believe there should be two commissioners, and they should be reporting not to the Ministry of Community and Social Services, but to an interministerial group of cabinet ministers. We believe there should be an advisory council, and that advisory council should be made up of people, especially who have lived experience of poverty, and that that would be integral to anything we do. And there is a people's review going on right now, which we widely quoted from, although that's in there. And Secretariat, we worked for free for the last 6 months, and we know what it was like just meeting coffee shops and things like that, so we think like to have adequate support for whoever does it. And then four goals, to engage in dialogue with representative group of Ontarians, draw on the expertise of the experts and the policy blocks, implement mechanisms to ensure all Ontarians have an opportunity to provide suggestions, advice, and opinions. We thought we'd need 18 months to do that. We've been accused of taking the government beyond its electoral cycle and therefore giving them political cover for that, but at the same time, it's unworkable to do a review really fast, not give anybody a voice, just so we could get it in before the next election. We really need to do better. It's really more important than elections. And then finally, to engage members of the provincial parliament and other leaders in the review, have a consultation process, and here's important, panel of experience, again, people with lived experience, modeled on the continuing people's review, which has people from all across Ontario. We have them in Toronto on several occasions, and we spoke with them. Public consultations, a separate review for First Nations, an expert panel, and then using the internet in order to have email input. We thought it would take about 12 to 18 months. That could be a bit ambitious. There's a little bit of alphabet soup here at the end, talking about the LTAS, which is the long-term affordable housing strategy, HISIC, which is the Human Services Integration Steering Committee, which is municipalities, and the Poverty Reduction Strategy, et cetera. I think I did that in 10 to 12 minutes. Thanks. Thank you.